Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast on all things coaching, brought to you by Animas. And now introducing your host, Yannick Jacob.
Well, Jerry Colonna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Yannick. It's really a delight to be here. And as I said, it's a real honor to be with you today.
Thank you so much. I've been waiting to talk to you for a little while. You didn't know that I've been waiting to do that.
For some reason, the message didn't come through. No, I did not know.
The first time I came across your work, I hate reading bios, right? Your bio is very impressive. So if you Google a bio and Jerry Colonna, you get to your website, you have a very illustrious career and a very inspiring story. I just moved to Berlin, hence viewers of the podcast, they will notice this looks a bit different. But I literally just had 12 hours in the car listening to your book again. So it's been nice to spend this time with you because you really reveal a lot about who you are and what's shaped you. And you tell a lot of stories from clients and what has shaped them. It's really, really interesting to see because you can read a bio of people, right? You've done JP Morgan Chase. You've been an investor. You've been a coach for what, 20 years now?
Almost, yeah.
18. Yes. You've written that book. You know, you've been a leader at age 25.
I've got book two sitting here on the desk as I've been working my way through it. So
amazing. So there's a lot there, right? But there's a lot more that is revealed when you actually get into the human story. So thank you, first of all, for revealing this because, you know, it doesn't go without saying. And to some extent, I want to get into that. And I think it's impossible not to. I wonder where to start.
Let me just thank you working your way through the book again, a second time. And thank you for the kind words about it. It was very much a labor of love. And I think the experience of putting myself out there is, as clearly as I did, I have a belief that there's something magical about memoir as service, you know, as a point of departure, if you will, for a deeper inquiry. Mm-hmm. And as I often say, it's really important for those of us who hold power to go first. And by dint of having a platform like a book, I have a certain kind of power in that relationship. And so the obligation is to show up fully and authentically and to go first. And then magic happens when those who lead go first and then go quiet at that point. But so thank you for those kind words.
So there's two points that I wanted to pick you up on, and I think they're a good way to start. The first one is going first, and the second one is deep inquiry. So let me start with the first ones first, right? Because often coaches get trained, and you know, there's this debate about, well, should we self-disclose? Does our own story matter? You know, shall we reveal ourselves? Do we go first? And I wonder to what extent that transfers into your coaching work.
Great question. And, you know, my first coaching experience was actually a therapy experience where I, as I describe in the book, I worked with a psychoanalyst for almost 30 years. After she passed, God rest her soul, I began working with another psychoanalyst. So I continued to hold that stance. And the traditional methodology is that which actually has its roots in Freud, has this notion of the analyst disappearing so that transference can happen.
They don't go first.
Yeah. And so there is a very important question around that with regard to coaching relationship. And of course, transference does occur in the coaching relationship, and there is something even therapeutic about it, although it is not therapy.
Yeah. Can I jump in there briefly? Mm-hmm. For those people who are listening, watching, who might not be familiar with transference, could you just frame that?
Sure. Transference is the process by which either the coach or the therapist becomes someone else in the psyche of the client. Mm-hmm. So probably because of my dashing silver gray hair, I become everybody's father. Hmm. You know, I'm being simplistic in it. It's a little bit more complex than that, but being aware of the potentiality of transference is extremely important. Now, transference occurs in almost all relationships. It's like, you're just like my father. No, I'm not, you know, but that whole experience. And so very much linked to projection, which is another experience. In therapy, a good therapist is trained to use the transferential relationship such that they can help the client work through issues that they might not have otherwise worked through.
Mm-hmm. So if the client feels that the coach is attacking them and they get on the defense, that's probably something that they've projected into their coach based on another relationship. And a good coach or therapist will pick that up. That's right.
Now, it's also incumbent upon the coach to understand that they may, in fact, be attacking the client.
That's happened.
There may, in fact, be a transference relationship going on there. Excuse me. So there's that going on. But to your first question, which I think is fascinating, is I think it's critically important to understand what it is that the coach is up to when they're speaking. You know, I've told this story before. Early on in my coach training program, I had a teacher who, in reviewing a coaching session that I had had, a recorded session, she gave me the acronym WAIT, WAIT, which stands for Why Am I Talking?
Yeah, I love that.
And sometimes the coach might go first, to use the language we were talking before, to satisfy an ego need that they have. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes they may be going first because of their own transferential experience. But sometimes the coach is going first to create safety.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to, it's very tricky. You have to be very, very careful because you don't want to collude with the client's unconscious and wipe them out if they have the tendency to see themselves as diminished in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
That all said, from a leader perspective, from one who holds power perspective, I think it's important. When I say go first, I mean demonstrate the qualities and values that you mm-hmm. wish to see in the world mm-hmm. by going first.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wish that my organization more transparent in its values and authentic in its presentation and of high integrity, mm-hmm. well, then guess what?
Mm-hmm.
I have to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just state it and expect it to happen, least of all from folks who are trying to stay safe in an environment that may feel wholly unsafe to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a long-winded response to a fascinating question.
So I've heard coaching being referred to as leadership, even equated to. And re-listening to your book, listening to some of the passages, thinking about the role of the coach when you describe the role of the leader was really interesting because a lot of it fits, but a lot of it is also different depending on how you think about coaching. So I wonder to what extent, if at all, the role of the coach is a role of a leader.
I think it's a nuanced but important difference. It's to think of the leader as coach rather than the coach as leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about the things that I think are hallmarks of skillful leadership, they include the extensive use of open, honest questions, non-agenda-based questions, curiosity, inquiry, self-management, the ability to, as I often say, have one eye on what's going on inside of me and one eye on what's going on outside, so that I'm operating in a regulated and high integrity way. I think that there's a challenge if the coach thinks of themselves as a leader, then and sometimes we see that, right? We see that when a coach conflates mentorship with coaching, where, and I know of one person who bills himself as a coach who does this, who says, well, wait, I'll run your meeting for you, then you do it exactly the way I did it. And you're smiling because that's not coaching. I mean, we both know that, right? In fact, that's disabling of the client's capacity and agency, right? And, you know, as we all know, those of us who are participating in this grand experiment called coaching, one of the core tenets of coaching is that the client is whole and not deficient. And the challenge with the coach as a leader, as a structure, as a stance, may inadvertently aggravate the client's view of themselves as less than capable, less than sufficient. And that's not our job.
Yeah. It can be really difficult to hold back what we think we know, right? There's a million different ways to lead. There's a million different ways to coach. But it creeps in for many coaches that, oh, I kind of know the answers. And given everything that you've done in your life, that must come up for you, I wonder.
Well, it comes up all the time.
Yeah. How do you manage that?
All the time. I generally will acknowledge if I'm going to take the coach hat off in that moment in the conversation and say something like, my favorite phrases are things like, I'm going to put aside coaching and I'm going to mentor a little bit, right? And, but I want you to understand that you're free to accept or reject what I'm about to say. Or I might say, hey, I'm going to be your brother right now. I'm not going to be your coach, or I'm going to be your uncle, not right. And what I'm trying to do is name the different stances that can arise. Right. Now, in my case, what does happen often is, there might be a very complex situation that's going on. Say a client's company is fundraising and they're in a negotiation with an investor. And I will note that I can offer some suggestions, but not from the stance of a coach. And as long as the relationship is trusting enough and open and honest enough, it tends to work. And my clients in particular appreciate that. What's critically important is that the coach understand when they're coaching and when they're not coaching, and are able to distinguish between those two. And I'm not sure that that's always the case for folks.
Yeah, I find that once I open the door into putting some helpful things on the table potentially and letting the client see if there's any value in that, or once you open that suggestion or advice door, I find that clients will want more and more of that. It's difficult to close it again. Do you find that as well?
I find it less difficult to close it again, and I know exactly what you mean. I do understand that. Sometimes that may be an indication that the client lacks confidence in themselves. And so, and I would advise a CEO to do the same thing. In that moment, pause and turn it into a question. Well, you know, if you did have a sense of what you knew to what you would do, what do you think would come up for you? Who might you ask for additional, right? And so all of a sudden it starts to become more open-ended, open and honest questions.
Yeah.
A technique I often use when I find myself being asked for that by a client is I'll often say something like, I understand that it would feel good if I gave you my point of view or my answer to that question, which of course is different than anybody else's answer. But humor me for a moment. I'll get back to that advice moment in a moment, but humor me for a moment. What would happen? And then I use that as a separate setup for the question. What I have found is that if you can redirect it in that moment, the client very often finds themselves without finding their own answer, which is that's the holy grail, right? Mm-hmm. So if you ever hear me in a podcast say, humor me for a moment, that's usually an indication that I'm feeling what you're just talking about and shifting the energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really like that. And I think it's a nice segue as well. At that point, it goes from something transactional to something relational, right? You're picking up on a dynamic, something that's happening here and now between us. You know, there might be some transference going on. There might be a parallel process. There might be some projection, but it's the curiosity about what's happening between us that opens the door into exploring other relationships you've had in your life where this kind of stuff emerges. And
well, how does it feel for you when a client does that to you?
Oh, usually I'm the one doing that. I wish more clients would do it. You know, I wish more clients would pick up on.
Well, I mean, when the client is asking you for advice, how does it feel for you?
Oh, well, part of me always feels on the spot, right? And that is still something that emerges. Now I don't respond to that anymore because I feel I don't have to offer the advice just because I'm asked. So that's a really freeing position because we've had that contract in place, right?
So at one point you felt like you had to give them the advice, is that right?
Yeah, I think a lot of coaches, when they're starting out, I think it's an experience for most that they feel they need to deliver this value thing. And if it can feel uncomfortable in the beginning to sit there in the not knowing, and we don't know together. So now I set my coaching up in a way that that's not an expectation. And if that's an expectation, that opens the door into asking questions and where's that coming from? And what are we doing here? And how do we do these things? So, you know, occasionally when I supervise, for example, coaches, I've specifically allowed myself to put some advice on the table occasionally and see what the coach does with that. But I'm very careful with it, let's say, because I don't want to have coaches mimic me or be the kind of coach that I am. I want them to be the kind of coach that they are. And that transfers to coaching clients as well, right? There's a million ways to be a leader. The way that I lead is not that way that somebody else lead and or the, how they should be leading.
So the line of inquiry that we're on right now reminds me of my early days in coaching. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling that if I didn't have the answer, the client would fire me.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, you're smiling too.
I'm so glad that's gone.
Yeah. But you remember that feeling.
I remember it well. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And for me, the feeling was not only rooted in the newness to coaching that I was experiencing, but a role that I played going back to even childhood where it was really important that I would have the answer. And I wonder if you can relate to that.
I relate to that in a somewhat different way, because what's rooted in my childhood is that my brother and my dad always knew everything and definitely better than me. So they were never wrong. So I couldn't really win, right? So it wasn't really my advice that was there, but this experience led me to either rebel, or it led me to ultimately, my coaching journey is based in that, right? To go into a profession where there isn't a right, because there's just your right and there's my right, you know? So I have understood over the years, that's why it's important to do your own work, right? That's what's being triggered. And I still have those responses and want to argue with a client occasionally that, but this is right. And that's still alive. I just learned to notice it early and not let it interfere with the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I can't help but speak because I'm speaking right now to clearly an experienced coach. I want to identify some of the things that I'm feeling and seeing in our conversation. Mm-hmm. One is, a few minutes ago, I talked about having one eye inward and one eye outward. And I think that you just demonstrated what I was just talking about. You're simultaneously aware of the propensity to do a certain thing and its roots, while simultaneously looking out to the other in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's quite skillful. I'm also, when you talked about your brother and your father, I felt a little sadness. And I felt that I had an image of a boy being overwhelmed. And I felt real empathy. And I knew what that was like for me. Mm-hmm. And now, because this is like meta, I feel closer to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because and of all of those experiences.
Yes, and that's why I'm quite comfortable. I think it's even important that we reveal ourselves. But then my wife is a Lacanian psychoanalyst. Right. So I live with an analyst that I'm sure evokes many stereotypical assumptions for people, but it's actually really amazing. Not that she's analyzing me in a stereotypical way, but her position of, you lose the position of the analyst as soon as you reveal who you are as a person. And my background
True.
Yeah, my foundation is existentialism, right? That's how I've entered coaching. So writings of Irvin Yalom, for example, writes beautifully about existential therapy, which, you know, has a lot of parallels with existential coaching. It's the stance of you and the client are in relation. And if you reveal yourself as a person, as an analyst, you lose your position. If you reveal yourself as a person, then you allow you and your client to connect on that personal level. And it makes them feel safe because it makes them feel they're talking to a real person. You know, and there's a lot of dangers with that, a lot of pitfalls potentially. So there really isn't a better way, I think, to work with someone. They're just very different ways of working with someone.
They're very, very different ways, and I think this is part of the challenge is that the therapeutic aspect that may show up in a coaching relationship is not the point of the relationship. Right. Whereas the point of an analytic relationship is therapy. Right. It takes skill to navigate both sides. I can make an argument that an analyst who is so hard and fast as to never reveal themselves may, in fact, get lost and undermine some aspects of the transferential aspect of the relationship. Think of the classic story making that a client may make to tell themselves about the authority figure who is the analyst who never reveals himself. It may be very similar to having a parent who's never actually showed up in a powerful way. So there's a line that my former analyst used to use with me all the time. When I started learning to coach, she used to say, there's a right way, there's a wrong way, and there's a way that works. And I think that framing is really important because it places on all of the helping folks the burden of saying, is this working or not? Because that can't be on the client.
Yeah.
That has to be on the person who's holding that position.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I mean, she would also pair it with, you meet the client where they are. And what she would mean by that is if the client comes at you with pragmatic, 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 then you respond with pragmatic, 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 so that you build the trust in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And then you slowly evolve and perhaps me at that point, you may start to reveal, or at that point, you may start to inquire more deeply in a particular vein. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why I think coaching by human beings and not algorithms is incredibly important, because the algorithms, and no matter how sophisticated the AI is, the algorithms are never going to be able to feel their way into what's working and what's not working, you know, in that moment.
So. Yeah. Ooh, that's a whole nother conversation that we could have, because I know there's a lot of talk around AI and will it replace coaching, or at least some coaching. And I think there's probably a point in terms of the performance, pragmatic, transactional kind of coaching. But just what you said just now, I don't see that ever happening either.
It's like, I'm not going to fall in love with the AI. I mean, maybe. I mean, there are movies about this, but.
Yeah. What was it called? Her, I think. It was a fantastic movie of this guy falling in love with the operating system. Right. But he's clearly projecting, right?
Totally. He's falling in love with an aspect of himself. You know, it's narcissism.
Aren't we all? But let's go a bit deeper in that. There was a wonderful lapsus when you were a guest on Tim Ferriss's podcast, I think earlier this summer. You talked about the importance of taking sabbaticals and having some time and really disconnecting. And at some point you said that it makes you a better therapist, a better coach. And I just absolutely loved that. So, given that it's deep inquiry, right, and given the importance that you put on childhood experiences and that you often seem to go there, regardless of how the coaching goes, at some point you seem to go there, take the doors that have just been knocked on or opened, and really inquire deeply into how you became the person that you are now. So coaching, therapy, I've heard you tell another story on the Coaches Rising podcast about how you've coached someone, but it was, I think it was something around an intervention around his dead father and if he were there right now. So there's clearly a very therapeutic element to it. And I wonder how, if at all, you draw the line or whether that's even important.
Well, I do draw the line and I do think it's important. And I draw a line, for example, if a client is consistently showing up with acute depression, then my job becomes to encourage them to seek professional help in that context. Mm-hmm. If what we're seeing is instead is a pattern in their work lives, where they are, to use a classic example I often speak to, conflict avoidant. Understanding the roots of that conflict avoidance, I think, is essential to being able to create the transformation necessary. Mm-hmm. So the way I think about it is, and the way I was trained as a coach, is to think about the presenting agenda that the client shows up with, and then move as quickly as possible to what's called the transformational agenda. Mm-hmm. What is really at work here? Mm-hmm. What are they really looking for? Yeah. And I don't think anyone calls a coach because they're happy with the status quo. Right? And so,
wouldn't that be nice?
It would be kind of boring. I don't know. And so I think, you know, where the parallels may be is in that wish for transformation, is in that wish for, this is not working and I need something new. Mm-hmm. I think if there's a strong parallel, I often think of the work of Carl Rogers, and Marty Seligman from Positive Psychology at Penn. I think that there is or cognitive behavioral therapy. I think that there is a kind of uplifted looking backward that good coaching should be based around. What I often say to a client is, we'll open up the closet. Let's straighten out all the stuff that you've got shoved in shoe boxes and then put it back. Because our job isn't to hang out in the closet. Our job is to hang out in the rest of the house. And so what we're really trying to do is understand how, as I said in my book, how who you were shows up in how who you are now. So that you can make conscious choices about who you'd like to be.
Yeah. And that's where we work with the present and going forward. But as part of that is how we show up in the present is rooted in our past. So I often hear coaches make the distinction between coaching and therapy as, well, therapy is about the past and the present. Coaching is about the present and the future, but the present is the past in a way.
What did Faulkner say? The past is never dead. It's not even in the past. It's always present. It's always present. I think sometimes that split that you just defined may stem from a coach being really uncomfortable in the messiness that the past can be, perhaps because they haven't done their own work, or perhaps because they are organized to look for simple, methodological based answers to complex questions. Like, I show up with anger at work all the time. So what are you going to do? Snap a rubber band around your wrist to make you not angry anymore? I mean, there is a little
some
bit
value
of that.
Yeah, of course.
And there's some magical thinking in that's somehow going to create the transformation that the client deserves.
Well, it's going to shift the symptom to somewhere
else.
You got it.
It's just going to show up in some other way, right? And so, our job is, as my doctor, my analyst used to say, to meet the client where the client is, to bring our whole selves, and to recognize when we're out of our depth, when it's better to then turn to, say, your wife and say, here's an analyst that you might consider, right? If you want to go deeper on this subject, here is somebody that you might consider. Here's a book you might read that will take you in that direction.
Yeah. There's two distinctions in there that is, I think, much more helpful to think about, is that particularly the one about the resourcefulness, right? If the client is whole, and it can be difficult for people to wrap their head around somebody being whole and somebody struggling, somebody having some stuff from their past that is deeply rooted and really in the way of them moving forward. But if the client feels resourced in terms of being able to open those doors and not being able to stop crying for an hour, but they're actually able to go through those doors and do some exploring, it might be difficult and there might be emotions and there might be tears. But, in essence, the client is resourced into that kind of inquiry. And the second one is, as a coach, are you willing and are you able to hold that kind of space for someone? And I think there's people who are willing to hold that space, but don't really have the necessary skills or haven't done the work. So they're getting involved, they're getting triggered, their own stuff comes in and it's not helpful, or they don't know what to do with all of that emotion, or they might just not want to. One of my early coaching trainers, he always said, he was a therapist, trained therapist, but at some point decided not to offer therapy anymore. So he would refer, even though he had the skills. And I think that's absolutely okay.
I think it's actually high integrity, because he's living into, his stated wish to transfer into a different modality. But if I can go back to the earlier part of that observation you were making, I think that one of the challenges, I mean, I think you said it well, but one of the challenges for all of us, and this includes leaders, our clients, as well as coaches, is first of all, do we actually believe our clients are whole? Or do we secretly wish, or do we secretly hold the belief that they are in fact broken, that they are in fact a problem that needs fixing? And if we're holding that wish or that belief, I'm revealing myself, then is that in fact a wish? Because if the client is whole, then why are they talking to me? Right? See, if we go into that relationship thinking that our job there is to fix the client and the client, and it works against this notion of the wholeness of the client, which then undermines my own position. The second thing is, if we are faced with an overwhelming set of emotions, do we know, I mean, you said it well, do we know how to hold those feelings without it triggering our own sense of helplessness? And maybe even an urgent desire to fix it. Shh, don't cry. Right? That kind of an experience of like, oh, no, make it better. We'll make it better. I'm sorry I opened that door for you. So, you know, this requires an enormous amount of skill and nuance and self-awareness and having done your own work.
Yeah, I wanted to challenge you on that earlier. I didn't feel the right time, but I really fundamentally believe that if nothing's wrong, people would benefit enormously from coaching. And I see that particularly in supervision. I would want any coach to be in supervision. I would actually want anybody who works, not just with people, but anybody who works to be in supervision. Supervision not as in having somebody superior, but having somebody on the balcony who's able to pick up on those kind of dynamics, who can help you reflect on your work. And what I see a lot with coaches coming to supervision, more and more they come because they think supervision is important. And I am so happy about that. So I would want them, once they start that journey in supervision, they then book sessions only when something is broken or they're stuck or they don't know what to do with a client. Something feels broken. And I would really want, I mean, in supervision, it helps. Some of my best learning in supervision I got when everything was going splendid and I didn't even know what to bring to the session. And I now offer that question to clients that don't know what to bring. Groups, for example, are fantastic because people turn up to a group. They don't book a session. The group happens monthly. So they're like, oh, I don't really know what to bring. How about your last session? How about the one from this morning? And there's so much learning every time. And that's the same with coaching clients, right? Somebody can have a fantastic, everything's running smoothly, but there's always something to learn. There's always grow insight. Nothing needs to be broken in order to learn. So I wish it was more the case.
Can I wholeheartedly endorse what you've just said?
Please.
you know, a clients often ask, what is the number one question that you should ask a prospective coach? And I always say, are you in coaching or supervision or therapy yourself? Because if you're not, and this is the only, I have a little quibble with the word supervision, only in the sense that it implies a connection to the training program. And it implies that when training is over, I no longer need supervision. I would argue that as long as you are mucking around the psyche of human beings, you need to keep your own work going. Because, you know, I go to therapy twice a week and I'm in a group supervision group once a week. And I intend to do that for as long as I'm out in the world. Because, you know, our own stuff is wily. Our own stuff can show up. And you're right. I think every one of those conversations is enormously helpful and makes me a better coach without a doubt.
Quickly,
I agree with you completely.
Yeah. Quickly, where's that association with a training coming from? Supervision.
I just think it's just my own feeling. You know, it's like I think of supervision. Like most coach training programs I know use the word supervision, whereas I think psychotherapeutic organizations refer to supervision as an ongoing practice. And I think my preference would be that the coaching profession sees supervision as a necessary component to certification, to maintenance of myself as a coach. Mm. Right. It's absolutely essential. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're getting there. It's becoming more important and people are more aware of it. And I also seen that trend that coaches go deeper and deeper and the lines between coaching and therapy get blurrier and blurrier.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much going on for people. And we would be quite limited, I think, if we not talk about emotions, for example.
Well, I agree with that observation. And I would add to the observation that there's this other trend, which is the counter trend, which is certainly here in the United States, because there is no requirement for any certification to call oneself a coach. Mm-hmm. There is also a blurring at the other end, where people are conflating mentoring, advising, consulting mm-hmm. with coaching. And so what coaching is becomes this very, very unclear and ambiguous state in sort of somewhere between, say, mentoring and psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yeah, and I talk to more and more people, coaches, who say, I'm not interested in the lines anymore because I work with people, and if they feel they find this valuable and they want to do more of it, then let's do more of it. What works, right? There's a right way, wrong way, and there's a way that works. I wonder how you think about that, because it certainly can help to put more of a frame around a profession, but it seems that some of the blessing and the curse of coaching, of the coaching profession, is that it is so incredibly open. And if you say I'm a coach, most people can't possibly know what that means unless you kind of explain a little bit how you approach the work. Do we need more regulation?
I think that there are a couple of things that I would say. One is, and I often think of the poet E. Cummings, who would often break the rules as it related to, say, capitalization and punctuation. Mm-hmm. But it's clear from his writing that he knew the rules. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think that it's very, very important that one understand the rules, understand, you know, some of the things we were talking about before, about transference, countertransference, and mm-hmm. projection, and what's happening. And I can't tell you the number of coach training programs that I am aware of that actually don't talk about things like projection. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you can do this job without talking about that, right? With regard to regulation, possibly, but I think that there's actually a greater need for a constant articulation of the ethics mm-hmm. of this relationship. And I'm not sure that regulation leads to reinforcement of the ethics. Mm-hmm. One would hope it does, mm-hmm. but there are plenty of people, both from a therapeutic perspective or from a coaching perspective, who follow all the regulations mm-hmm. and yet are unethical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ethics is a series of questions you need to ask yourself rather than a rule book.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think the answer to should you sleep with a client is unequivocal, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Should you take advantage of the transferential relationships so that you can manipulate the client?
Oh, yeah. No. There's some that most people agree with. Although there was sex therapy in the 70s. Yeah. They thought that could cure people.
Right. Well, yeah. What was going on there? Right? I do think that there are really moral and ethical questions that are applied in all of our interpersonal relationships and all of our dynamics. Mm-hmm. And there is a power differential mm-hmm. that exists, and being aware of all of that. And I don't know of a lot of regulations that actually prevent, right? I mean, mm-hmm. in the United States, psychotherapists are highly regulated, right? If you're certified mm-hmm. in one state, you may not be able to provide services in another state, mm-hmm. which in the age of Zoom is an interesting challenge, right? Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in the regulations that would necessarily say, don't use the relationship to manipulate the client to make yourself feel better. Mm-hmm. Which I think a heck of a lot of folks do. Mm-hmm. So anyway, long-winded response.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to ask you about the importance of your own story, and that is one's own story as well, right? Because it strikes me that a lot of the coaches that are out there inspiring a lot of people, a lot of the very successful coaches, certainly, they seem to have lived through really heavy experiences. You were in a very deep, dark place at some point, which you write about in your book. I recently had another coach see a session, and he's been close to death a couple of times. And it's this kind of experience that gives a lot of coaches this presence to sit with someone and hold that kind of space. I've been blessed with not very traumatic childhood, as I would say. I mean, other than what I've shared, it's not had that kind of impact that I would consider myself traumatized in any way, right? So I've had a pretty good life and pretty fortunate not to have been in really deep, dark places. I mean, I had my fair share of existential crises, but you know, compared to your story, other people's story, it doesn't quite go to that kind of level. And Erwin Yalom, who I mentioned before, he's lost his wife during the writing of his latest book, and then he's reflecting on that. And he said he's a better therapist for it, being able to relate to bereavement in a different way now. So I guess the question here is, to what extent do we have to live through similar experiences? And is that helpful, or might that be in the way when we work with people?
Remember what I said before, the move that I often make? I'm about to make this move. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll answer your question, but humor me for a moment.
Sure.
Ask the question again, but put an I statement in it instead of a you statement or a generalized pronoun statement. Hmm. Ask the question from another place.
I wonder to what extent is it in the way or beneficial for me to have gone to a similar place or experience that my client is bringing into the room?
So let me reflect back the question I'm hearing, and you tell me if this resonates. You seem to be wondering if your lack of trauma gets in the way of you being the best possible coach you can be.
Yeah, there's something that definitely resonates.
Stay with that question for a moment.
Yeah. There's, I was trained phenomenologically, right? In the existential frame. The notion that my experience is not like anybody's experience, even if we both got married or got our dream job or lost our parents or had a near-death experience, nearly drowning. Everybody's experience is completely different. So what I experience isn't really important for me to be the best possible coach I can be in this regard, right? I've been exploring for a number of years to work with psychedelics and what coaching could offer to that kind of space. And pretty much everybody I talk to in the psychedelic community says, yes, absolutely, you have to have had all of your experiences and you need to have gone, and you can't take a client further than you have gone before. And with my phenomenological stance, I can't help but challenge that, because I don't need to have been a CEO to work with a CEO and help give them a space to reflect, right? I don't need to know what it's like to be working in insurance or to become a parent. You know, I have become a parent recently. Is that gonna make me a better coach to another parent having parent issues? I don't think so, you know, but so I've been faced.
I see you working it out in your own mind. I see you hearing a kind of whispery voice that says, because I did not experience a particular trauma, I may not be the kind of coach that I'd like to be. But then what comes up quickly is a honestly felt but somewhat intellectual response, which is, you know, well, the phenomenologists have shown that since our experiences are unique, right? So, and so you're grappling with it. I see that. Okay. I appreciate your sharing that, because it helps me understand even better the roots of the question, because I could feel that tension that was going on inside of you. I'm highly influenced, you know, we've been talking a lot about therapy, but I've also been highly influenced by my faith, my spirituality in Buddhism. And one of the core tenets is the primacy of compassion. And a root capacity that builds compassion is empathy, which of course relies upon the ability to have one eye looking inward, to understand your own experience, so that I can have a connection with the other person, and from to bring it back into coaching, so that I can create the presence necessary for that client's transformation. So I can be a facilitator for that client to have the life that they want. You may not have had, you're right, from a phenomenological point of view, your experience is different than mine. We could have had exactly the same experiences of trauma, and you'd still have a different experience.
Yes.
My siblings, right? But I would argue there are universal experiences. They're feelings. And in the moment in which you're trying to create an empathetic bridge in which the client can then, using with your compassion, client can then do the transformation that they deserve. You can reach in to know what it feels like to have your heart broken, even if you did not go through a divorce. You know what it's like to stare at something that you love wholeheartedly, even if you didn't become a parent. You can connect to those feelings. And in that connection, you create the opportunity. So that's one thing. I want to close with one additional observation.
Go ahead. Because I noticed that a lot of really excellent coaches are former or current actors. And I think that's exactly what's happening, right? As an actor, you learn to connect with something within you,
right?
To play the role authentically. You have had a different experience, but you connect to something that is a similar experience, and you go into that place and you channel that. So
it's the coaching stance. I mean, you're talking about the Stravinsky method, method acting is that notion of being able to surface that own experience. But I think that is true for all of our interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
Right. I can imagine what it's like to have my heart broken. Mm-hmm. I can imagine what it's like to be fired when I thought I was succeeding. I can imagine what it's like to feel like a failure.
Yeah.
Right.
But then be careful with the, assumptions that come up.
Question, be curious about the assumptions that come up. Use them as a means of connection and dialogue. The other phenomena that I get concerned about when folks, I say, look at my story and see the experiences of the challenges that I have, is that they romanticize the challenge.
Hmm.
And they see themselves as less than because they didn't have suicidal ideation at a depression, or they didn't act out in some particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is dangerous. And I'll reinforce the core message. None of that is necessary for you as a coach to feel compassion.
Mm-hmm.
That is really empathy based.
Mm-hmm.
And none of that is necessary for you to be able to use your imagination to stand shoulder to shoulder with your client and witness their transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's the magic. That's the glory. That's what we do. That's why we do what we do.
Yeah. You mentioned transformation there. You mentioned it earlier. And one question I usually ask guests, right? Because the school is a school that trains coaches in transformative coaching. When you say transformation, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, I'm very, very fond of a particular Jung quote, which is, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate.
Mm-hmm.
It's that moment. To me, that's the ultimate transformation. That's, you know, the subtitle of my book is Leadership and the Art of Growing Up. And people will often say, well, what is an adult? What is a grown-up
mm-hmm.
in that way? And it's someone who is committed to that process of transformation on a daily basis. It's a practice of transformation. It's a practice of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a practice of staying awake.
Mm-hmm.
And when we fall back asleep, we wake up again.
Hmm. I love that. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm having an eye on the time. One thing I still wanted to ask, and it's more on the practical side of things, right? Coaches love it when they have something they can put into practice. And I've picked up a bunch of really, really good questions that you seem to ask your clients often. So I wonder if you could share some of those questions that you often find yourself asking a client that seems to open certain doors.
Well, the famous one, which I wish I would get a penny for every time it's repeated on the internet, I'm kidding, is how have I been complicit in creating the conditions I say I don't want?
I wish I had a penny for the times that you mentioned it in your book.
Right. Right. Well, and it's really important that I talk about complicity, not responsibility, because it often gets misunderstood as me trying to invoke a sense of guilt or shame. It's not. It's really curiosity. But I think that the more important question, the question that isn't so widely discussed, is how has that benefited me?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, if we think about what our clients come in and they'll say, you know, this is happening again. And it's like, well, let's look at the secondary benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I firmly believe that patterns persist because they meet a need.
How's this serving you, right?
And if it doesn't meet a need, it's not going to repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and until you get that need met, you're going to keep repeating that pattern.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a really, really interesting framing. I would argue that that's an essential question in coaching,
mm-hmm.
is to really look at the way in which whatever it is that they're coming in with, their presenting agenda, is in service to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what is it, how else might they get that need met,
mm-hmm.
other than the behavior that they so desperately want to change?
Yeah, it's inviting to take responsibility. In what ways are you complicit to what's happening here? And I love how you lay it out as well in terms of, what was that? You worked with someone and said, oh, my CFO, there's a greediness. Head of sales, yes, exactly. And well, who hasn't fired him? Who has hired him? Who chose to promote him? And if you do that in a safe space, then, you know, the client might as well go on some introspection. And I'm a big fan of inviting people to take responsibility. And if a client then gets defensive or guilty or ashamed, that's something to be very curious about.
That's right.
You had a few questions there around... what needs to be said that isn't currently being said? And there were two other versions of that question.
Let me restate them. So the first one is, what am I not saying that needs to be said? And that's a really, really powerful question, because we often, especially those of us who grew up with violence, often train ourselves to say nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really curious question. And then the corollary questions to that are, what am I saying that's not being heard? Mm-hmm. And that speaks to not being listened to. Mm-hmm. And then, especially for those of us who have power, what's being said that I'm not hearing? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those who have less power than we do will speak with other than words. Uh-huh. So they might speak with actions. Yeah. And so if somebody is consistently late to their job, what's really being said there? Uh-huh. And get curious about that.
Yeah. Great. Any others?
Well, and this really speaks to the work that I'm, the book I'm working on now, which From My Lips to God's Ears will be out this summer.
Oh, great. I don't need to ask you about it now.
But it's how have I been complicit in and benefited from the conditions in society I say I don't want.
Hmm. Say a bit more. Right?
Sure. So we live in a world where folks' belonging is constantly challenged, mm-hmm. whether it's by dint of a darker pigmentation, mm-hmm. whether it's by an immigrant status, mm-hmm. whether it's by religion, by economic status. And we all benefit from these conditions in some way. And the lack of curiosity. So it's like taking those self-inquiry questions that are sort of internally focused and really looking out at the larger world and say, how have I benefited from this? Mm-hmm. And what would I give up that I love, mm-hmm. in order to see that condition change? Mm-hmm. Am I willing, for example, to put my safety on the line? Mm-hmm. And my sense of wholeness, mm-hmm. in order to lean into difficult conversations. Am I willing to be wrong, mm-hmm. in order to learn?
Mm-hmm. Right? That feels like there's a more systemic angle. Like Reboot feels quite personal. This seems to be going more outward.
That's exactly what this is. This book is called Reunion, and it's really looking at the phenomena of othering that occurs in multiple layers within, mm-hmm. Our society and our organization. And the question really is, what is the person who's well-intentioned, who leads with a certain kind of ethics? I've done my work implicit in Reboot. Now I want to see this manifested in a different world. What if, for example, the purpose of a business was not just simply the amassing of wealth, mm-hmm. but the creation of belonging on a systemic, mm-hmm. basis? Mm-hmm. What if we turned our organizations from a means of extraction into the means of generation of love, safety, and belonging, mm-hmm. for everybody? Mm-hmm. So that's what the new book is about. And I'm excited.
Well, thank you for that work, because it's sure very necessary if we, you know, want to have a chance. So
that's right. That's right. I think we have a moral obligation to ask ourselves those questions. I really do.
Yeah. Jerry, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for making time. I remember fondly when I was on a research journey to look at who writes about existential leadership. And mm-hmm. I found a couple of quotes by you that I absolutely loved. And ever since then, I kind of wanted to talk to you, but you know, it took a while. So I'm glad that it happened. I would recommend any coach to read Reboot because you prose it in questions. Each chapter has a question of self-inquiry, and there's so many coaching questions in there that I think would be, it's just very practical and embedded in a wonderful story. So I'd recommend anybody to go there. The two Tim Ferriss episodes you've done are fantastic. There's a wonderful story about why you have a big spider tattoo on your back. Go there, you know, read, please go engage with Jerry and his work. Jerry, thank you for the work that you're doing. I appreciate you. Thank you for making the time. And I'll leave it at that. Is there anything else you wanted to tell people?
Oh, I just want to thank you, Yannick, for the work that you're doing. It was a thoughtful, engaged conversation. And clearly, you know, you've thought about big issues, and I appreciate your work. And I want you to enjoy Berlin and enjoy being a parent. My oldest is 32. My youngest is 25. But I do remember 8 months old. So
I think part of parenthood is to forget about these elements so that you can have more children.
Indeed. Don't worry. You'll sleep again.
She's a good baby. Jerry, thank you so much. See you around.
I'll see you soon. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Coaching Uncaged. If you want to find out more about becoming a coach, developing your coaching skills further, or training as a coaching supervisor, then head along to animascoaching.com. Thanks again, and catch you on the next episode.